Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program is designed for people learning English. We speak slowly, using a simple style and limited vocabulary. Today, Anne Ball brings us Ask a Teacher. We also have a report from Jonathan Evans. And we close the show with an American story by O. Henry. But first, Ashley Thompson and John Russell.
For 15 years, Yalkun Rozi published textbooks with traditional Uyghur poems and stories. His books reached millions of Uyghurs, many of them students, in China's far western Xinjiang area. Rozi was successful because he seemed to know how to deal with Chinese officials and their rules. That all changed 3 years ago, when the ruling Communist Party launched what it says is a campaign against ethnic separatism and religious extremism in the area. China began arresting even well-known respected Uyghurs like Rozi. Between 1 and 3 million ethnic Uyghurs have been detained in so-called re-education camps across Xinjiang. Those numbers come from the United Nations and independent observers. Rights groups say more than 400 leading intellectuals, writers, performers, and artists are among the detained. Critics liken the government's campaign to cultural genocide. They say the government is targeting intellectuals as a way to weaken or even end the Uyghur culture, language, and identity.
Rozi, who is 54 years old, was one of the first well-known Uyghurs to be detained. Police seized him in 2016. He was later sentenced to more than 10 years in prison on charges of trying to subvert state power. Rozi's story shows how even Uyghurs once accepted by the government have been renamed enemies of the state as part of the campaign in Xinjiang. He had many friends among government officials. He was able to use his connections to sell his books, said Abdulweli Ayoub, a linguist. He knew Rozi through a Uyghur bookstore Ayoub once headed. Those books sold very well, he said.
About 11 million Uyghurs live in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. They speak a Turkic language and use an Arabic-based writing system. Many are active, practicing Muslims. Uyghurs are culturally, linguistically, and religiously different from China's majority Han people. Han Chinese have increasingly come to Xinjiang, a resource-rich area, and hold most of the well-paid jobs and powerful government positions. For years, Uyghur intellectuals acted carefully, working in support of their culture while avoiding being identified as separatists or extremists. They succeeded through periods of calm and periods of intense government control in Xinjiang. Rozi's friends, family, and former classmates describe him as sharp, hardworking, and very careful. As a college student in the 1980s, he stayed away from the pro-democracy movements taking place in China and avoided speaking with known activists. He rose to fame among Uyghurs through heated debates that were broadcast on television. He developed important ties with state officials, which permitted him to write about sensitive issues like Islam and Uyghur identity.
Rosie urged his people to become well-educated. It seemed like on TV and in state propaganda, all we did was sing and dance, Rosie's son Kamal Turk Yalkun said from the United States. He and other family members now live there in exile. My father didn't like this label. In 2001, the government named Rosie as leader of a committee responsible for gathering Uyghur literature textbooks. He and his family moved into a housing area with Xinjiang Education Press editors. They debated world events over meals with others in the close community of Uyghur intellectuals and writers. Rosie kept a large study area overflowing with books. He had grown used to dealing with the government's fears of an independent Uyghur identity. Although he sometimes had to fight back against censors, his works always made it to publication. His family's wealth and the situation among Uyghurs in general suffered after a series of terror attacks in Xinjiang in 2014. The attacks took place just after Chinese President Xi Jinping came to power. In answer, the government began its intense surveillance and security crackdown.
In 2016, Chen Chuanguo became the top Communist Party official in Xinjiang. Before that, he served 5 years as the party chief in Tibet. Observers consider Chen to be one of the architects of Xinjiang's internment camps. Rosie's arrest came soon after Chen's arrival. Rosie's books were soon removed from bookstores and libraries. Soon, Rosie's former co-workers at Xinjiang Education Press began disappearing. Colleges held political meetings to denounce problematic textbooks, including Rosie's. The books were described as treasonous. They were considered to have poisoned Uyghurs with ideas of splitting China. Those textbooks weren't political at all, Rosie's son, Kamal Turk, said. There were things in there about taking pride in being ethnic Uyghurs, and that's what the Chinese government was upset with.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry directed questions about Rosie's case to Xinjiang officials, who did not answer requests for comment from the Associated Press. Experts say the campaign against Rosie's books is part of a systematic effort to distance young Uyghurs from their language and culture. An area-wide ban on use of Uyghur language books in schools began last year. It's a slow process of cultural re-engineering to reshape Uyghur culture from top to bottom, said James Leibold, a professor of Chinese ethnic studies at Australia's La Trobe University.
Today, Kamal Turk, his sister and mother, are trying to increase attention to Rosie's case from their small home in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Kamal Turk plans one day to finish translating into English what remains of his father's works. One of Kamal Turk's biggest regrets is that he did not take all of his father's textbooks with him when he left China. He worries some may be lost forever. Nobody thought they could be a target, that they could vanish one day, he said. It's shocking that they're gone.
Rwanda says its citizens should consider using electric motorcycles in an effort to protect the environment and cut fuel costs. Passengers and motorcyclists say the electric vehicles could change how Rwandans do business. James Musisi is one of 10 drivers who have started using the motorcycles in what is known as the moto taxi business, motorcycle taxis. He says the vehicles are quiet, which means passengers are able to make telephone calls while they travel. Electric motorcycles are relatively low in cost when compared to other vehicles. One such bike costs $1,300. That is less than the $1,600 price for motorcycles that require fuel. Musisi notes that the electric bikes also require fewer repairs. Kigali, Rwanda's capital, has 2 charging stations for electric-powered vehicles. A moto taxi driver has to bring a dead battery to take a charged one, which runs for 70 kilometers. The price for recharging an electric vehicle is equal to the cost of the fuel for traditional motorcycles. In 2016, 4 business leaders formed a startup company called Ampersand. Its aim is to create a mass market for commercial electric motorcycles in Rwanda. Josh Whale is the company's chief executive officer. He has high hopes for electric motorcycles in Rwanda. He says, "For electricity, we found that the grid is sufficiently reliable in Kigali. There has been a lot of investment made in new electric transmission lines, which are operating well. So everything is good for us." Rwandan President Paul Kagame recently announced that his government plans to replace all motorcycles with new electric ones. He said, "We will find a way to replace the ones you have now. We urge taxi moto operators to help us when the phase-out process comes." The push for electric motorcycles follows other moves the government has taken to protect the environment and keep Kigali clean. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Ernie Andrews looks out to the grounds of the historic Langston Golf Course in Washington, D.C. He notes that fewer young black golf players are coming out to play these days. Andrews is a longtime professional golf teacher and manager at Langston. The course was once one of the few in the United States where African Americans were permitted to play the sport. Today, though, Andrews feels hopeful. A sports star recently donated a large amount of money to restart a golf program at the historically black Howard University. This could help grow new interest in the sport among young African Americans. "This is a great sport, and we have too much tradition as a people trying to get into the sport to lose it now," Andrews said. Stephen Curry is a leading player in the National Basketball Association. His gift to Howard in Washington is bringing new attention to golf at historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs. Few African Americans are currently playing the sport at the college and professional levels. HBCUs play a major part in increasing diversity in golf. The National Collegiate Athletic Association, or NCAA, says only about 300 of the more than 10,000 college golfers are Black. And just 3 African American golfers are on the Professional Golf Association's tour. Tiger Woods, Harold Varner III, and Cameron Champ. More than half of the collegiate Black golfers compete at HBCUs. However, those programs are always struggling for survival. Only about 25% of the more than 100 HBCUs have golf teams, said Craig Bowen. He is president and founder of the Black College Golf Coaches Association. Howard University ended its golf program back in the 1970s. Last week, Curry intervened. He donated some of his great wealth toward a 6-year deal to help Howard relaunch its men's and women's teams for the 2020-2021 school year. Some HBCUs struggle to find Black golfers, so they include white players on their teams. The golf programs are usually among the first to get targeted during budget cuts. It's not football or basketball generating dollars, said Bowen. He has coached golf at Illinois' Chicago State and Benedict College in South Carolina. Both schools are HBCUs. In 1997, Tiger Woods became the first African American and the youngest player ever to win the Masters tournament. The event is held at a golf center that once did not permit Black players. Many observers at the time believed his win would lead to a new generation of African American players on the PGA Tour. But that did not happen, partly because of the high costs linked to play at the professional level. Curry loves to play golf. He made the announcement about his Howard donation at Langston. African Americans made steady progress in golf after the opening in 1939. Charlie Sifford joined the PGA Tour in 1961. After the organization ended a whites-only policy that kept golfers of color shut out. In 1964, Althea Gibson, a tennis star who also played professional golf, became the first Black woman to play in the Ladies Professional Golf Association Tour. However, Ernie Andrews said, young golfers still have to fight the opinion that golf is a white man's sport. He hopes that a rebirth of HBCU golf teams will help bring more young African Americans into the sport. Golf is a great way to teach discipline and perseverance, he said. We use golf, but the real teaching is about life, Andrews said.
This week, we answer a question from Ashraf in Egypt. He writes, can you explain the difference between habit, custom, and tradition? Dear Ashraf, great question. All three words relate to actions that are done repeatedly, The difference is that traditions and customs are practiced over a long period by many people. A habit is more informal and is usually limited to one person. Let's talk more about traditions and customs first. Traditions can include what most people in a country do on holidays. For example, sharing a meal with turkey is a Thanksgiving tradition in the United States. Or, fireworks are part of America's July 4th holiday tradition. Customs are also usual ways of behaving, but they are not as old as traditions, and they are practiced by fewer people. Here's an example. In the American workplace, it is the custom to shake people's hands when you first meet them. When a custom continues from generation to generation, it becomes a tradition. For 50 years, my grandparents had a custom of swimming in the lake on the first day of summer. Now my aunts, uncles, parents, and cousins do it too. Summer swim is our family tradition. In comparison, habits are about just one person's behavior. A habit is something that a person does often in a regular and repeated way. Here is an example. When she reads the newspaper, Jane makes it a habit to look at the weather first. We hope you will make it a habit to visit our website every day. And that's Ask a Teacher.
The Romance of a Busy Broker. Pitcher, who worked in the office of Harvey Maxwell, broker, usually allowed his face to show no feeling. This morning, he allowed his face to show interest and surprise when Mr. Maxwell entered. It was 9:30, and Mr. Maxwell was with his young lady secretary.
"Good morning, Pitcher," said Maxwell.
He rushed to his table as if he were going to jump over it, and he began to look at the many, many letters and other papers waiting there for him. The young lady had been Maxwell's secretary for a year. She was very beautiful and very different from most other secretaries. Her hair always looked plain and simple. She did not wear chains or jewels. Her dress was gray and plain, but it fitted her very well. On her small black hat was the gold-green wing of a bird. On this morning she seemed to shine softly. Her eyes were dreaming, but bright. Her face was warmly colored, and her expression was happy. Pitcher watched her. There was a question about her in his mind. She was different this morning. Instead of going straight to the room where she worked, she waited. She seemed not to know what to do. Once she went over to Maxwell's table, near enough for him to see that she was there. The machine sitting at the table was no longer a man. It was a busy New York broker.
"What is it? Anything?"
asked Maxwell shortly. Papers lay like snow covering his table. His gray eyes looked at her as if she were another machine.
"Nothing,"
answered the secretary, moving away with a little smile.
"Mr. Pitcher," she said, "did Mr. Maxwell talk to you yesterday about getting another secretary?"
"He did," Pitcher answered. "He told me to get another one. Several are coming to talk to us this morning, but it's now 9:00 and not one has appeared."
"I will do the work as usual," said the young lady, "until someone comes to fill the place."
And she went to her table. She took off the black hat with the gold-green bird wing and put it away as usual. If you have never seen a busy New York broker on a busy day, you know little about men at work. Every minute of a broker's hour is crowded, and this day was Harvey Maxwell's busy day. Beside his table stood a machine. From this came a long, narrow, endless piece of paper bringing him business news as soon as it happened. Men began to come into the office and speak to him. Some were happy, some were not. Some were in a hurry, some were full of anger. Boys ran in and out with letters for him to read and answer at once. Pitcher's face now showed that he was alive. The other men who worked in the office jumped around like sailors during a storm. And there were storms in the business world, fearful storms. Every storm was felt in the broker's office. Maxwell moved his chair against the wall. Now he was like a dancer. He jumped from the machine to his table, to the door, and back again. In the middle of all this, he slowly realized that something had come near him. There was golden hair. There was a very large amount of it, high on a head. On top of the hair was a big hat covered with bird's wings. There was a long silver chain hanging from a neck until it nearly touched the floor, and among all these things, there was a young lady. Pitcher was beside her to explain. "Lady for that job is secretary," said Pitcher. Maxwell turned half around with his hands full of letters and paper from the machine.
"What job?" he asked.
"Job as secretary?" Pitcher said again. "You told me yesterday to have someone sent here this morning."
"Are you losing your mind, Pitcher?" said Maxwell. "Why should I tell you anything like that? Miss Leslie is a perfect secretary. She can keep the job as long as she wants it."
To the young lady, he said, "There is no job here." And to Pitcher, he added this order, "Tell them not to send any more, and don't bring any more in here to see me." The silver chain left the office, hitting chairs and tables with anger as it went. Pitcher said to another man in the office that Maxwell was more forgetful every day. The rush of business grew wilder and faster. Maxwell was working like some fine, strong machine. He was working as fast as he could. He never had to stop to think. He was never wrong. He was always ready to decide and to act. He worked as a clock works. This was the world of business. It was not a human world, nor the world of nature. When the dinner hour was near, things grew quieter. Maxwell stood by his table with his hands full of papers and his hair hanging over his face. His window was open, for it was the time of the year when the weather was beginning to turn warm. And through the window came a soft, sweet smell of flowers. For a moment, the broker was held there, without moving, for this smell of flowers belonged to Miss Leslie. It was hers, and hers only. The smell seemed almost to make her stand there before him. The world of business grew smaller and smaller, and she was in the next room, 20 steps away.
"I'll do it now," said Maxwell half aloud. "I'll ask her now. I wonder why I didn't do it long ago."
He rushed into the other room. He stopped beside the secretary. She looked up at him with a smile. Warm color came into her face, and her eyes were soft and kind. Maxwell's hands were still full of papers.
"Miss Leslie," he began quickly, "I have only a moment. I want to say something in that moment. Will you be my wife? I haven't had time to make love to you in the usual way, but I really do love you. Talk quick, please. I have to get back to my work."
"Oh, what are you talking about?"
cried the young lady. She rose to her feet and looked at him round-eyed.
"Don't you understand?" said Maxwell. "I want you to marry me. I love you, Miss Leslie. I wanted to tell you. So I took this moment when I wasn't too busy. But they're calling me now. Tell them to wait a minute, Pitcher. Won't you, Miss Leslie?"
The secretary acted very strangely. At first, she seemed lost in surprise. Then tears began to run from her wondering eyes. And then she smiled through her tears. And one of her arms went around the broker's neck.
"I know now," she said softly. "It's this business. It has put everything else out of your head. I was afraid at first. Don't you remember, Harvey? We were married last evening at 8 in the little church around the corner."
That's our show for today. But we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. I'm Katie Weaver.